Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Brexit, German royalties and venue tax. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week, which is true, but also not strictly true, because we're recording this episode early and that week has not yet happened.
Yeah, different disclaimer this week, because usually the point is we've taken 19 weeks off since the last podcast. So when we say the last week, we actually mean the last 19 weeks.
Yeah.
Whereas this time we have a podcast coming in, bam, 7 days after the last one. But I'm going to Denmark, good old Denmark, which means we've come into the studio.
It is good.
A little bit.
I have a moment for Denmark. I like Denmark.
I've come into the studio and he's come into the studio a little bit earlier this week so we can record a podcast before I head off to Denmark. And as a result of that, we need to put in the other disclaimer, which is if something really big happens in the music business towards the end of this week, as you're listening to this last week, we ain't going to talk about it.
Did that make sense?
It definitely made sense.
Okay.
if you drew a diagram above that sentence, you would find that it was grammatically coherent.
Okay, I'm sure it was. I'm sure people will work it out anyway. The point is, a week has not yet happened. However, luckily for us, quite a lot happened at the beginning of last week.
Yes, we were not short of stories, which we expected to be. So we're just relying on...
Last week in this case, I'm talking now in future time, not current time.
That definitely didn't make sense. The point is...
It made more sense than yours.
There might be a big development that happened in the last 7 days of music that you're expecting us to discuss, but it hasn't happened yet. In the same way that last week we talked about the Grammy Awards that had not yet happened.
Yeah, maybe this could be our new thing. We just talk about... just get ahead of ourselves.
Maybe something as significant as the Grammy Awards has happened since we recorded this, but we're not talking about it. Because as it turns out, there's plenty to talk about, even though the week is not yet done.
Yeah, I mean, the other disclaimer we should put on it is that any of these stories that we're going to discuss may have had an update to them that we're now seemingly ignoring, but that's because we don't know it's happened, because we're in the past.
Yeah, so if you listen to our Grammy Awards special...
This all makes sense, right?
Last week. Did you listen to our Grammy Awards special last week?
Multiple times.
And you thought that it was a little bit... shocking that they didn't mention that one of the big events that happened over Grammy weekend, which wasn't even really anything to do with the Grammys itself, but which definitely had an impact on the big two Grammy Awards events that happened on the Sunday, was the death of the basketball player Kobe Bryant, mm-hmm. which was relevant because the big Grammy show was happening at the Staples Center in LA, which is also the home to the basketball team that he spent his whole career playing. So it definitely had an impact on the show. We didn't mention that on our Grammy Awards special because the Grammy Awards hadn't happened at the point that we recorded it. Because, as I think we discussed at length last week, so much had happened behind the scenes in the run-up to last week's, or this month's, oh, this is all getting very complicated now.
It's like Inception.
To the 2020 Grammy Awards, that we have plenty to talk about, even though the awards themselves had not yet happened. Some other things did happen behind the scenes,
yep.
didn't they?
So, yes.
Because obviously we weren't really talking about the Grammy Awards. What we were talking about was the big bust-up between the owners of the Grammy Awards, the Recording Academy, and their ousted CEO, Deborah Duggan. That was all we were really interested in because we're only interested in arguments, beefs and litigation at CMU. We don't really care about celebrating artists for their musical magnificence. And so that's what we talked about last week. There were a handful of further developments over the Grammy weekend in relation to that story. A few more statements went back and forward. Diddy said something. Do we still say Diddy or do we say P. Diddy?
I think he calls himself Diddy.
He does.
That's where he's at the moment.
But I think for some reason... In our style guide, we kept him as P. Diddy. Is there another producer called Diddy? Was that the issue?
I think there was some sort of legal battle. I think possibly in the UK, technically, he's still called P. Diddy.
And that's
but
why.
I don't think it matters.
Sean Combs.
Oh, him, yeah.
Got an award because it was Grammys weekend. Lots of people had an award. But he got one of those sort of lifetime achievement awards that are dished out at the various dinners that happen around the Grammy Awards. And he was pretty much the only sort of big name winner who acknowledged or referenced the big fallout around the Recording Academy and the departure of Deborah Duggan and all the debates around the lack of diversity at the Recording Academy and the Grammy Awards in his speech.
Yeah, so he was receiving the Salute to Industry Icons Award.
It's a terrible name for an award.
And it was at a pre-Grammys event on the Saturday evening because there's so many Grammys awards, they have to have multiple events to get rid of them all.
So it's a kind of lifetime achievement award, wasn't
yes.
it, that he was being handed, which is how he got away with doing, I believe, a 40-minute acceptance speech.
It's too long. You don't want a long acceptance speech at an award ceremony. Well, I suppose this wasn't a full award ceremony where you've been sitting there for hours already and you really don't want, you just want to get home.
But still, 40 minutes is quite a long time.
It's too long.
I hope there were some good gags in there.
Well, he had some good stuff to say. I didn't notice many jokes, but he had some stuff to say.
So he referenced the Deborah Duggan Recording Academy fallout, although he didn't specifically get into any of the allegations that she had made the week before the awards. But he did hone in on the diversity debate that has been happening again because of Deborah Duggan's ousting. Although looking at it less so on gender diversity and more on sort of ethnic and music genre diversity, basically, he, like quite a lot of hip-hop and rap and R&B artists before him, said that he still felt that the Grammys still weren't properly honouring hip-hop and other black music, even in 2020, and that it's time they fixed that.
Yes, which, I mean, that was comments sort of echoed after the actual proper Grammys ceremony by Tyler, the Creator, who won the Best Rap Album Grammy.
At the main event.
At the main event for an album that, I mean, it's a pop album with a bit of rapping on it. It's not a rap album. And he said he was very excited to win the award, but he felt a bit ambivalent about it because he felt like, why wasn't this up for a pop award? Why is it sort of lumped into Best Rap Album?
Yeah, like
when
the
it's
Grammy,
not a rap album.
So the Grammy people don't really understand that side of music. And I suppose, you know, before all of this, when the Deborah Duggan thing was first kicking off, Chuck D also put out a statement saying something very similar.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, in the history of that genre, Chuck D, Diddy, Tyler, the Creator, representing all the genres of hip-hop, in agreeing that this is still an issue in the Recording Academy in 2020. And so Diddy wants it fixed, not another task force, not another review, not another initiative. He wants it fixed, and he set a deadline.
He did. He started a clock, and that clock was counting down 365 days, so to the next Grammy Awards. And he said, yeah, you've got until next year's Grammy Awards to sort all this out. Or, I mean, I don't know what the repercussions were going to be for that. I mean, it's not like there have been any repercussions on any of the other countdowns.
Yeah, but this is Diddy this time.
Yeah, maybe he's going to do it differently.
Diddy has spoken. So maybe this time the Recording Academy and the Grammy Awards will finally sort out all of the many multifarious diversity issues that organisation seemingly has. The chair of the Recording Academy, who's been very vocal since Deborah Duggan was pushed out as CEO,
yes,
sent an email around the next morning.
Yes.
To everybody. Well, everybody who's a member of the Recording Academy. I think that email had already been written. This was not a response to Diddy.
Yes, because obviously the obvious thing to say would be like, you've had a female task force who you've sort of ignored. You've had a female CEO who you've dismissed. And then Diddy has come along and said, you should sort this out. And you've gone, oh, all right. Because that's basically what the email said.
It is what the
email
said.
It was
a
long email, but it basically said, oh, yeah, all right.
We'll better do that stuff. But I sense that email had already been, well, we know it had already been written on Saturday because that's what the rumour was. But also, I suspect the aim of that email, it wasn't a response to Diddy. It was trying to have the last word before the proper Grammy Awards got underway. So
yes.
They were like, okay, we'll send out an email on the morning of the Grammy Awards, a Sunday, and then we can have the final word with our membership before the proper Grammy Awards go live, before the TV show begins. But it didn't work.
No.
Because Deborah Duggan's lawyers, I assume, got wind of this. And I mean, they issued a response almost immediately.
That was a great response.
Basically saying, you're just repeating what Deborah Duggan had already said.
We should say, rather than just, Mason's email did say the Recording Academy is perfectly willing to change and wants to do so, and we're going to implement all sorts of things to make sure there is a greater diversity across the whole Grammy Awards and across the Recording Academy, and we're going to sort it all out. It had some other comments on Deborah Duggan and trying to push her out of the debate, but as you say, she came right back into it when her lawyers responded to that email.
And basically they were saying, this is a list of stuff that Deborah Duggan was trying to do. The person who was stopping this from happening was Harvey Mason. He's now just basically sending out the things that she already had set in motion. And then it went on a bit of a rant saying, the biggest problem here is Harvey Mason. And the conclusion was, the only way to instigate all this stuff in this email is to sack Harvey and bring Deborah back.
Yes, which that would be quite a conclusion to this story.
Which was the bold statement. So this is ongoing as we record this. Because as we've already said, we're recording this a little bit earlier in the week than we usually would. But basically, everything we talked about last week on the Grammy special, yeah, that's still going on. That's kind of a summary, isn't it? of the what's been happening since the last podcast.
I guess so, yeah. It's not what we're here to talk about this week.
We are not here to talk about the Grammys. We don't care about the Grammys. Gone. Happened. We've forgotten about them. We will never talk of them ever again.
No, this week we're actually going to discuss German artist managers' moves to change how digital royalties are divided up in the country and the UK government's cuts to business rates for grassroots music venues. But first, we're going to kick off this week with, well, it's basically some Brexit news, isn't it? Because by the time this goes out, we will have officially departed the European Union.
Yeah, this is the first set list post-Brexit, although technically we're in the transfer phase, aren't we? The interlude.
Transition.
Transition. They changed it. Didn't they call it something else originally? Anyway, it's the commercial break, basically. So as of last week, the United Kingdom is no longer properly a member of the European Union, although we're still obeying all the rules for now.
Mm.
But
officially until the end of the year.
Clearly
longer than that.
Because having spent 3.5 years negotiating the deal that allows us to start negotiating the deal, we are now starting to negotiate the deal.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Any listeners outside the UK and Europe, that's a basic summary that should make perfect sense.
That's where we're up to. We've negotiated the deal to allow us to negotiate the deal, and now we're negotiating the deal as of yesterday, or today really, I guess, if you're listening to this podcast as it goes out.
Mm.
That is what is happening. The UK government has decided that it's only going to take 11 months to negotiate this unprecedented, incredibly complicated agreement on the UK's future relationship with the European Union. But I suppose day to day, because we have this, what are they calling it? Transition period.
Yeah.
The interlude, the commercial break. Because we've got this bit where
one's calling it the commercial break.
Where we are negotiating the deal. Day to day, everything's carrying on as normal, I guess, in that we still have free movement of people. We are still following EU rules, and that's going to go on till the end of this year. But, I mean, if the government was to agree a deal in the next 11 months, and it's still insisting that it can.
It can't.
It can't. Or it were to say, at the end of this year, having not agreed a deal, screw it, we're just going to exit without a deal.
Which would be silly.
Which would be silly. But if any of those things happen, it could be that on the 1st of January 2021, the UK is properly outside the European Union. And then all of those endless questions that we've been asking over the last 3.5 years about how we'll get basic medical supplies and food and drink and things to eat and all of that. Well, those questions are back in the air, I guess.
I've been keen to find out.
Being a fan of food and drink and medication. But this is a music...
Yeah, love them.
This is a music business podcast. So, of course, as the Brexit process properly gets underway, after 3.5 years of it not getting underway, all of those questions that we've had at various music industry conferences in recent years are back on the agenda.
Hooray!
And I guess the biggest remains, how easy will it be for British artists to tour the other 27 countries of the European Union as of the 1st of January 2021?
We don't know.
And will there be new bureaucracy and or money to be spent every time artists go on tour?
We don't know.
So we don't know. But obviously, the music industry has a wish list of what it would like to happen. So that's the most pressing thing. I suppose we should also acknowledge that just as pressing is whether European artists will be able to come and play in the UK without any new costs or bureaucracy. Because we don't want to have music festivals in this country and music venues in this country with no European artists playing. Because there's at least...
If anything, we want more.
There's at least 6 European artists I really like.
Okay.
So it would be a shame if we couldn't have them playing.
I mean, that's most
forward.
Of the artists you like, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, pretty
so
much. I don't like British artists. They can all go away. That's one of the big pressing things. But there are other questions as well about moving merchandise and physical product around the country. And, of course, the bloody copyright directive.
Yeah, the European Copyright Directive, which the British music industry spent 5 years fighting for, campaigning for, fighting the tech lobby for, which, I mean, that's not an easy task, but they got it through. In the end, the European Copyright Directive was passed into law last year. It's in the process of being implemented around Europe. There's a deadline of June 2021 for all European member states to implement it. Currently, even though officially we've left the European Union, the UK is adhering to those European laws and so technically should be in the process of implementing that copyright directive. But despite having implied, and certainly the previous government, that it would still implement the directive. And despite, since the start of the year, Culture Minister Nigel Adams saying that the government supported the aims of the directive, the government has now said not doing it.
We are not implementing the European Copyright Directive. As you say, there was a point at which the UK government definitely implied, and I think it sometimes outright said, that whatever happened with Brexit, they would implement the Copyright Directive. There was a period, because the Copyright Directive kept slipping, because certain aspects of it, in particular what was then Article 13, the safe harbour bit, was proving so controversial, the Copyright Directive kept slipping, but then Brexit kept slipping too.
Yeah.
And so there was a period of, well, what will happen first? Will the Copyright Directive get passed, or will Brexit go through? What order will it happen in? If the directive goes through first and then Brexit, will we implement it? If it's the other way around, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, for quite a long time, the government indicated that it would probably implement the Copyright Directive, whatever. Generally speaking, most elements of the directive had the support of the British political community. Certainly, most aspects of this directive were strongly lobbied for, not just by the music industry, by other copyright industries here in the UK. But of course, I mean, last year, we had so many changes of government and ministers, it was hard to keep up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And by the end of last year, once Boris Johnson had had his election win, it did start to feel like, well, hang on a second, given Boris Johnson is adamant that the transition period is only going to last to the end of 2020.
It won't.
But he's still adamant. Yeah.
I know, sorry.
And given...
just going to caveat it.
That when a directive passes in the European Union, within the directive, there is then a time period that all the member states have in order to implement the changes. Because what happens with a directive of the European Union is it doesn't directly change law around the EU. Each of the member states then has to take the directive and implement it into their local laws, and they get a period of time to do that. For this directive, it was 2 years. So I guess basic maths was, if the government gets its Brexit agreement in place by the end of this year, as it still insists that it will, even though it won't, and given that the 2-year deadline for implementing the directive is into 2021, that definitely the obligation to implement the directive is not there. And by the end of last year, it really felt like the will to do it voluntarily had gone.
Well, not least because British Prime Minister Alexander Johnson said that he didn't think it was a very good law.
No, he tweeted.
He was bad-mouthing it because it was a European law, and European laws are rubbish.
As the directive went through, he was tweeting that this piece of European law being forced on the British and their creative industries that had lobbied so hard for it was a terrible piece of European legislation. Anyway, we had this confirmed just over a week ago because an MP put in a question through Parliament to the relevant minister, and the relevant minister, who sits in the Department for Business Innovation, whatever that department's now called, he confirmed that they would not be implementing the Copyright Directive.
Yes, so this came in response to a question from Cardiff MP Joe Stevens, who wanted to know what was going on with the European Copyright Directive, and a minister for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, Chris Skidmore, said exactly what you have said, that assuming the government sorts out its trade deal by the end of the year, which it's definitely going to do, then there was no need to implement the European Copyright Directive, and so it just wouldn't.
But he did then say at the end of his statement, any future changes to the UK copyright framework will be considered as part of the usual domestic policy process. So I suppose he wasn't ruling out there being any changes to copyright law in the coming years. And of course, as you've already mentioned, his colleague over in Department of Culture, Media, Sport, Digital, whatever that's called these days, Nigel Adams, had said just days before this, 2 days, 48 hours before this, because they had the music industry's great debate for some reason in Parliament. And as part of the music industry's great debate, Nigel Adams said, we support the aims of the Copyright Directive. I mean, he was being a little bit non-committal in his statement.
Well, he gave lots of positive statements about the music industry that were all quite non-committal.
Presumably preempting the confirmation from his colleague that the directive would not be implemented. But he was saying, we support the aims of the directive. So I suppose that's the interesting question for the music industry now, which is, well, that's annoying that having spent 5 years collaborating within the UK industry, because remember, I mean, we talked about this endlessly on Setlist, didn't we? This was a campaign which unusually brought together the majors and the indies, the labels and the publishers, the artists and the songwriters and the managers and the collecting societies all came together and campaigned for this within the UK, and then they joined up with their counterparts all over Europe. Does this now mean that the UK music industry has to do it all again in Westminster and Whitehall to try and get a bespoke piece of legislation through the British Parliament to basically implement those elements of the Copyright Directive which were relevant to the music industry? And if it does, can it just sort of take a cut and paste of the directive and then go and find some friendly people in Parliament and try and get this enacted? I mean, it's that thing, isn't it? Take the European Copyright Directive, delete European Copyright Directive off the top.
Put British Copyright Directive.
Put, I don't know, the Great British Commonwealth Restoration Reform Institution Act. And then maybe all of those Conservative MPs who got elected in the last election will just vote it through. But for the music industry, it does mean that on top of all the other Brexit nonsense, there is this extra unknown in the next few years as the rest of Europe implements the Copyright Directive, of which, of course, the most notable bit for the music industry is what was Article 13, Article 17 in the final version, the Safe Harbour reform, which will increase the liabilities of websites like YouTube. Is the music industry now back at the start in trying to get those reforms in the UK? Or is it just a case of taking what was done in Europe, changing the language a little bit, and then trying to push it through Parliament as a British piece of legislation?
So the music industry will be hoping the latter, because if it's the former, I mean, it's generally thought that the tech lobby will have much greater power over Britain on its own rather than as part of the European Union, and so could win in either blocking that legislation or getting it watered down in the ways that it attempted to when it was being debated in the European Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely considered that the Google lobby in particular is much stronger in London than it is in Brussels. Plus, of course, post-Brexit, the general assumption is those big, rich companies like Google will start, in essence, holding the British government to ransom by saying, oh, we'll keep a lot of our European base in London if you give us this, 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 and this. Otherwise, maybe we'll relocate to Berlin or Frankfurt or Paris. So yes, it could well be that Google, well, we know for a fact that the tech lobby and Google in particular will fight any proposals in the UK, however close they may or may not be to what went through in Europe. And there is that fear that they would have a stronger hand at the negotiating table on a UK-specific piece of legislation than in the rest of Europe.
The music industry does have a possible ally here, though, that being the newspaper industry, which is a fairly powerful lobby.
That is true, and that will be interesting, won't it? Yeah, so it's important to remember that when the European Copyright Directive was slowly, agonisingly, tediously working its way through the lawmaking process in Europe, although we always talk about Article 13 as being the big controversial article, that being the Safe Harbour reform, the one the music industry really wanted to get through, the other really controversial bit of the directive was what was originally Article 11, and that was all about news search sites. So again, Google really was on the receiving end of this.
Yeah.
It was about Google News and the fact that services like Google News pull in headlines and links from newspapers and trying to provide newspaper owners with extra rights over their work to basically try and force the Google News service and services like it to monetize what they do and pass some money back to the newspaper owners. And generally speaking, most newspaper companies support Article 11. And so I would imagine most of the British newspaper companies will want something like that implemented into copyright law, which gives the music industry an ally in terms of, well, if we're not going to implement the Copyright Directive, we need to implement some of these measures pretty quickly, please, British government, British Parliament. And of course, that will be interesting if we have the newspapers lobbying over here, which will include those newspapers who have been passionate supporters of Brexit, passionate supporters of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, which you have to feel, well, I mean, one of them is his boss. Because he still writes for the Telegraph now and then. So you have to feel those newspapers will have sway. And obviously the newspapers have traditionally had a considerable sway in London, much more so than in Brussels. Mm. So it may well be that, yes, by allying with the newspapers, maybe even if they're going to ignore big chunks of the Copyright Directive, the copyright industries together, the newspapers, the music industry, etc., can get some copyright reforms through Parliament. Whether or not they will have enough momentum to actually get Parliament and government to put together a bespoke Copyright Reform Act, I don't know. Although, of course, what the government does currently have already on its agenda is what, well, the UK government has referred to as the online harms debate, or what some people call the platform responsibility debate. So the UK government last year published a white paper all about responsibilities of digital platforms. There are similar conversations going on in Brussels for the rest of the EU. And really, that's about things like combating fake news and the distribution of criminal content and extremist content online. Those are the sorts of things that are really coming under platform responsibility and online harm. But the music industry was already trying to get copyright into that debate. So So that might be where things like safe harbor reform and the news linking changes could find a relatively quick way of getting onto the agenda in Westminster by becoming part of this online harms platform responsibility conversation. Even though when the UK government published its initial white paper on that topic last year, copyright was not included in there.
But even if the music industry, possibly working alongside the newspapers, did manage to beat Google and get safe harbour reform put into UK law as part of the platform responsibility stuff, there are other articles in the European Copyright Directive that are relevant to the music industry that aren't part of that, mainly about increasing the rights of artists and songwriters in relation to their corporate partners, i.e. the labels and the publishers.
Yeah, of course, when the whole Copyright Directive was going through, Article 13, certainly in the music industry, got the most press. Actually, just in general, Article 13 got the most press because YouTube went on that ridiculous consumer-facing assault that it was going to kill the internet. But it's important to remember that in the Copyright Directive, from a music perspective, after what was Article 13 became Article 17, there's then some extra reforms which are also relevant to music, but which are really about increasing the rights of artists and songwriters in relation to labels and publishers over things like transparency and fairer deals and renegotiating old, outdated contracts and things like that. And they were there in the final version of the directive, so they are going to be implemented across the rest of the EU. It's quite interesting to watch how different countries are considering implementing that. So the question is, well, if the directive's dead in the UK and the music industry has to start again, even if, as you say, it can get the safe harbour stuff into platform responsibility, I mean, these artists and songwriter rights, well, they're not platform responsibility. They're label publisher responsibility. So they don't really belong in that area of reform. So the question is, well, does that mean they just get lost, or does there have to be a separate push to get them in? I don't know.
Or do they just ditch that? I mean, that, well, you said like the entire music industry came together to lobby for the European Copyright Directive. Maybe there becomes a split again when the artists and songwriters suddenly think, well, now the labels are just trying to get rid of that bit of legislation so it doesn't apply to us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to be cynical, you could say,
I do.
Many of the labels,
a long time.
Certainly the majors, don't really like those other elements of the European Copyright Directive. They like the safe harbour reform, but not the other bits. So in some ways, if through all of this here in the UK, we lost all the other bits, but we did get safe harbour reform through platform responsibility, well, actually, that's a win for the more corporate end of the music industry, which will mean that the artists and songwriters and their trade organisations and the managers and all of that are probably going to have to work extra hard to get those rights here in the UK as they watch their colleagues elsewhere in Europe slowly but surely get those rights as the directive is implemented. So I think the conclusion of all of this is, those of you who thought that we'd never have to talk about the Copyright Directive again on this British music industry podcast,
we've got a whole new one to talk about.
It looks like there's going to be another 5 years of talking about this from a specific UK perspective to look forward to.
Oh, good.
Thanks to Brexit.
Still to come, some government policy that's actually been welcomed by the UK music industry.
Who'd have thought?
So that'll make a nice change. But now, over to Germany, where they haven't left the European Union and apparently have no plans to do so. Because, let's not get into that. But the managers of some of Germany's biggest artists have written to the German divisions of all three majors and BMG, demanding a discussion over how streaming income is shared out between the various stakeholders in the music industry. Those managers who represent acts like Rammstein, Die Toten Hosen and Helene Fischer argue that there is an urgent and fundamental need to review the current streaming business model and to confirm if current practices are legally compliant.
Yeah, so this is basically what we have always referred to as the digital pie debate.
Yeah.
Although this is happening in Germany. Do they have pies in Germany?
I'm sure they do.
Strudels, really, isn't it? They have in Germany. Is it not more like have a strudel and a pie? It would be good, actually, because...
I don't know. Would that be the same? There's fruit isn't a strudel. Do you have, like, you wouldn't have a meat strudel, would you?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't. I'm vegetarian, but...
That's exactly. So what a stupid thing to say. They don't have meat pies in Germany, do they? They just have sausages.
Sausage pie?
I don't think
this is what we're really supposed
sausage
to be discussing. Strudel.
The reason why this is relevant is when I...
Sausage strudel, that's like a hot dog, really, isn't it? A sausage roll.
Well...
Yeah, maybe they have sausage rolls.
Well, that's kind of a meat strudel, isn't it, if you think about it?
This is definitely not what we're discussing.
The reason why this is relevant is, obviously, I have stood up in a lot of rooms.
You have. I've seen you.
And talked about the digital pie debates.
Yes.
many times, and I have some lovely slides that I present to illustrate the digital pie debate.
Mm.
But it was pointed out to me about a year ago that my diagrams for the digital pie are rectangular, not circle.
Yeah, that was an oversight.
And that what I was actually illustrating was the digital strudel debate, not the digital pie debate.
Oh, I see. So there was a point.
That's why I'm glad that this debate has finally arrived in Germany. And I suppose the point is, nothing that we're about to talk about really is new. We're just going to do a quick summary of the digital pie debate. But the reason why this is interesting is the fact that the managers of the biggest artists in Germany have stepped forward and demanded meetings with the majors to discuss this.
And BMG.
And BMG.
Which is big in Germany, which is why it's part of the debate too. I mean, it's big everywhere, isn't it? But it is a German company.
Particularly big in the German market. The reason why that is interesting is that it is proof, if we needed it, which we probably didn't, but it's good to have proof anyway, that Germany is finally a streaming music market.
Oh, yeah.
After years and years of it being one of the two big recorded music markets where people were still buying plastic discs.
Mm.
Now, people do still buy plastic discs here in the UK.
They do.
I have heard. And not just vinyl discs either. But of course, over the last decade, it has definitely been the case that whereas, if we look at the big recorded music markets, the US sped away to become a digital music market really quickly. Here in the UK, we were sort of somewhere in the middle. Meanwhile, Japan and Germany were where CD sales held up the strongest for longest. Japan is still a CD market, still making more money selling plastic discs than anywhere else. And it's only really in the last few years that we've started to see Germany become a digital market, so that of all the money coming in, just like here in the UK, the US and elsewhere, now for German artists, an increasingly significant portion of their recorded music revenue is coming from digital, and specifically it's coming from streaming, which is why the German managers are now having the digital pie debate that we were having here in the UK, well, 5 years ago with my strudel diagrams.
So the digital pie debate is really, it's a debate about how digital income is shared out between the various stakeholders in any one recording as it is consumed in whatever digital format. For both downloads and streams, they've really had the CD model applied to them. There's very little difference between how the money is split up. And a lot of people think that that's not the right way to do it.
Yeah, so this is how does the money get shared out between the main artists, the session musicians, the songwriters, the labels and the publishers. And as you say, when downloads first came along in the mid-2000s, basically the way the money had been split up when selling a CD was applied to when you sold a download on iTunes.
Because they kind of just went, well, it's a new format, but it's still a format.
It's just a digital version.
It's a digital version
of selling
a CD. It's the same, just carry on as normal.
So we'll take that model, we'll apply it to this new digital thing. And what that means is, when it comes to recordings versus song, because obviously in the track, there are two different copyrights being exploited, the recording rights and the song rights. And with a plastic disc, the vast majority of the money always went to the recording rights, a little bit went to the song rights. And then once the money had landed with the label on the recording rights side, under a traditional record deal, obviously every record deal is different, the record deal could say that 99% goes to the artist. But that's not what a classic record deal says. What a classic record deal says is that less than 80% of the money will go to the artist. So actually on a classic CD deal back in the day, well, not so far back in the day, in the 90s, it would have been 15% going to the artist. If you go back to the 60s, it would have been a few percent.
And the reason for that is that the labels did, you know, for all the knocking of the labels that we can do, the labels were the party in the whole process who took the greatest financial risk. They were the ones who gave the advances to the artists. They then spent money on marketing. They spent money on pressing up all those CDs and vinyl and cassettes or whatever. And so therefore, it was decided that they deserved the biggest chunk of the money in order to recoup what they'd spent.
Yeah, and I mean, manufacturing all of those discs, getting them all to the shops.
And shipping them around the world.
Shipping them around the world. And then when nobody bought them, taking them all back and destroying them was a lot of work. Very expensive. Spend a lot of money. So yes, when it works, the label gets the most money out of it. But of course, as soon as we went over to downloads, and even more when it all shifted over to streams, the argument is, well, the labels aren't pressing up any CDs anymore. All of those costs, all that risk has gone. So therefore, artists should be getting more of the money and the songwriters and publishers should be getting more of the money, is the argument. We should note that, obviously, every record deal is different. But in the main, artists on major label deals usually are getting a few percent more on a stream than they did on a CD. And when it comes to how the money gets shared out between the song and the recording, a few percent more is going to the song on a stream versus a CD. So there has been a slight reslicing of digital pie that has happened over the last 15 years. But I think most artists and most songwriters and publishers would say we're not talking about a reslicing of a few percent. We're talking about quite a significant reslicing of the pie or strudel, whichever you prefer.
And clearly the German managers would agree with that. And we know they'd agree because they wrote this letter that we've been talking about to the major labels and BMG, which was actually sent in December last year, but has only just been published by the German business press. In that letter, these managers and their lawyers request a meeting with all the record companies in February to bash this out. Warner has already said it can't make the meeting, but it's happy to meet them separately from everyone else at another time to talk about it a bit more privately.
Yeah, the managers were suggesting a round table, basically, with all three majors, BMG and all the managers and lawyers.
Did seem optimistic.
To hammer this out, Warner Music, in a statement to one of the German business papers, who've gone quite big on this story, has been widely covered in the German media. I've been told on the grapevine that one of the German tabloids, called Bild, went with the angle of bloody pop stars wanting yet more money, which I thought was quite interesting, because that's not really what these managers are asking for. But in the business press, yeah, Warner are basically saying, we can't have a roundtable discussion on this. That would be cartel trading. That would be competition law problems. But we're happy to sit down with these managers and discuss the current model. Of course, whether or not the majors can be forced, litigated, persuaded, embarrassed into offering the artists a better deal, well, that's hard to tell. If you get the Dissecting a Digital Dollar book that we've talked about endlessly on set lists. But if you get yourself a copy of the Digital Order book, which obviously we at CMU produce,
link in the show notes,
with the Music Managers Forum, there are lots of arguments on both sides. There are lots of proposals on if we, as in songwriters, artists, publishers, agree that those people should be getting a bigger cut of the pie, but realistically the labels aren't going to just give that up, it then poses the question, well, how do you make that happen? Is it a case of interpreting record contracts in a specific way? Is it a case of interpreting copyright law in a certain way? Should we argue that so-called equal numeration, the money that artists directly get from radio stations and pub, clubs, bar, cafes, should apply to streams too? Could copyright law intervene? Arguably, an element of the European Copyright Directive does provide a forum through which certainly artists on old record contracts who feel they're being hard done by could seek to renegotiate those contracts. So the question is, assuming the labels don't just say, here, have more money, which seems unlikely, how do you go about further reslicing the digital pie? And that varies from country to country because it depends what copyright law says. It depends how the law generally feels about meddling in contracts. Has to be said, German copyright law does meddle quite a bit in the way that artists and labels work together.
Yeah, and that bit of the copyright directive you mentioned there is actually started as a piece of German law.
Yeah, so it does feel that you're more likely to get German copyright law intervening in this way than you would here in the UK. Because UK copyright law doesn't tend to intervene in that way. And indeed, we talked earlier about maybe the labels will be quietly pleased that some of the copyright directive is not going to get implemented here in the UK, providing they can get safe harbour reform through some other way. Because there was an argument that this idea in the European copyright directive about allowing artists to reopen old contracts and reinvent them for the modern age, well, that goes against the spirit of British contract law, blah, blah, blah. Whereas, arguably in Germany, there is more of a precedent for copyright law to intervene. So who knows? But it will be interesting to see how that conversation proceeds. It will be interesting to see whether user-centric royalty distribution is also being floated as part of those conversations. That doesn't mean that artists get a bigger slice of the pie, but some artists will get more money. So who knows? So it will be interesting to see how that conversation progresses. But as I say, actually, what's really interesting about this is the fact that this is the sign that Germany is now a streaming market. And it's all about how much money you make from the streaming services if you're a successful recording artist in that country.
Now, as we said, BMG received this letter along with the majors because of its status in Germany. But unlike the others, it would probably be a bit more happy to receive it because BMG would argue that it's already doing this. It's already changing things for the better and slicing the digital pie differently.
Yeah, because remember, this is the new BMG, so it's not the old BMG, which was a major record company that then obviously the record label bit got sold off to Sony. This is the BMG that launched in the latter part of the 2000s, and it has always made a big deal about how on the recording side, it is more on the services model that other companies have also adopted in the last 10 years, but that's very much at the core of what BMG does, rather than being an add-on on the side as it is at the majors. And BMG have been saying for a number of years now, the relationship between artists and labels is changing. Inevitably, that means that the way the money gets shared out will have to change. So in some ways, I think BMG would have been very pleased to receive this letter because it's kind of the managers making a stand on something that BMG itself has actually been quite vocal on in recent years, and which now is clearly going to be a big talking point in its home country.
Well, clearly, if its statement on this is anything to go by, it's fairly pleased that this is happening. A spokesperson for the company said, "We strongly welcome this attempt to highlight some of the inequities in the traditional record deal. This letter is signed by some of Germany's most respected music managers and should be taken seriously. We need a sensible grown-up debate. We do not find it justifiable in a world in which record companies no longer have the costs of pressing, handling and delivering physical product for them to try to hold on to the lion's share of streaming revenues. The world has changed. It is time for record companies to change too." Then it doesn't say, and be more like BMG, but maybe they took that bit off.
Yeah, sort of implied, isn't it? So we'll see what happens with this next. It does make me think that maybe it's time for us to translate a digital dollar into German. If anyone's listening who would like to undertake that task, maybe now's the time to do it.
This is not a podcast for you to pitch for work. Anyway, that's the end of that story. And finally this week, after much campaigning from the music industry, we're looping back round in this episode, but this is different because there's been relief in the music industry about something the UK government has done.
Yes, different side of the music industry and a different outcome.
Yes.
So this is something that the UK government has announced in the last week that is good, that the music industry has welcomed, and that is why we are going to dedicate the least time to it on this edition of Setlist, because
we don't like happy stories.
This is a sensible change. The only cynical bit of this is, why didn't this happen years ago? But nevertheless, it is a good change, the outcome of some very savvy campaigning by the music industry. So this is to do with grassroots music venues and the business rates that they pay. Because obviously, we all know grassroots music venues here in the UK have been struggling in recent years for all sorts of different reasons. That's a problem for everybody in the music industry because playing those venues is still so important for most new artists. Yes, okay, six artists worldwide will launch themselves on TikTok, but all of the others will launch themselves by getting out there and playing live, honing their music, honing their performances, finding an audience that way. So we all need grassroots music venues. We know it's hard to run a grassroots music venue in the 21st century here in the UK. There are various reasons for that, but one of the reasons is not only do you have to pay rent on your venue, you have to pay the local authority business rates. And the argument is that business rates for venues are way too high, and sometimes it's the rates that send these venues out of business. Not only that, but two annoying things. There was a wide-ranging review of business rates in part of the UK a couple of years ago, and it was felt that that was not done in a very good way, so that small music venues saw their rates rocket. Well, the example UK Music always give was about the Lexington in London, wasn't it? And then the nearby Emirates Stadium.
Yeah, so the Lexington had seen its rates rise by 118% between 2016 and 2017, and then Emirates Stadium, a much larger venue, had seen its rates fall by 7%.
So that seemed like that was not a good development.
No.
In that most recent review of business rates in England. And then, to add insult to injury, the government did introduce a relief scheme for small businesses on the high street, recognising that the British high street is in disarray and companies are going out of business, and we're just ending up with high streets full of betting shops and pound shops and charity shops, and that's pretty much it. And so there was some business rates relief introduced for small businesses on the high street.
Which that included pubs.
It included pubs, and it should have helped music venues, except that music venues were deliberately excluded from that, which meant that if you were a pub where everyone drank in silence, you got the relief. But if you had a band in the corner playing music, then you didn't get the relief, which was mad. And the Music Venue Trust and various other organisations in the UK have been shouting about that for some time. And hurrah, good news. Finally, music venues are being given a break.
Yes, because the government has now announced what it is calling the pub relief, which this time will include music venues, and that will be a relief on business rates. So small and medium music venues will be able to claim a rate cut of 50% up to the value of £51,000, which for most small and medium venues will be a full 50% cut.
Yeah, so this is a new relief scheme which finally includes music venues in the mix. And of course, the thing to always hammer home with these sorts of conversations is that for most of the businesses who will benefit from this, that saving could be the difference between this venue continuing to operate and not operate, because that's how tight a budget these venues operate on. So every single saving that we can get, every stupid extra expense we can remove from the equation, the more likely we are for these venues to stay in business.
Yes, and when the Music Venue Trust put out a statement welcoming this, it also had quotes from a whole load of small venues welcoming it. So it's definitely... it's a positive story to end on. Everyone's very happy.
And as the Music Venue Trust itself said in its statement about all of this, this is the third positive development when it comes to grassroots music venues. So whereas with the Copyright Directive, it feels like maybe we're back to square one. Whereas with Touring Europe, it feels like all the trauma is still to come. When it comes to grassroots venues, we had the Agent of Change thing, didn't we? Fixing another stupid bit of law where property developers could put residential properties next to existing venues and then cause all sorts of issues that resulted in venues going out of business. We had the Arts Council setting aside some of its funds specifically to support initiatives in grassroots venues. Now we've finally got the business rates thing. And I mean, kudos to Music Venue Trust, who have really, really worked incredibly hard with their community to get all three of those things done. Obviously, there are still all sorts of challenges for industry, government and everyone to meet, but at least... for grassroots music venues, it does feel that the campaigning has worked and things are definitely moving in the right direction. And given that British artists may not be able to afford to tour the rest of Europe come 2021, at least there'll be some venues here at home for them to play instead.
Oh, so you managed to twist that round a bit at the end and make it slightly less positive. So well done on that.
Well, we started with Brexit. We'll end with Brexit. This is the first post-Brexit sort of edition of Setlist. So, you know, we should champion all of that.
And this new tax relief will come into force in April when we'll be well into, well, whatever we're into now. No one, do we know?
The interlude.
The interlude.
Commercial break.
Yeah. The everything is normal, but still uncertain and annoying.
So anyway,
I mean, that is normal now, isn't it?
Despite us insisting on returning to Brexit, just to confirm, we're finishing on some good news.
I thought we were all going to stop talking about Brexit now that they've got Brexit done, supposedly. But that's all we've got time for this week. So why not join us next week and see if we talk about Brexit again? I think it's a special edition in it next week, so probably not.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That will mean no Copyright Directive and no Brexit. It will be a good episode to tune into.
Yeah, don't listen to this one. God. This one was all about Brexit. Terrible one to listen to. But if you have any feedback on this week's episode... I was going to say, if you want to chat about Brexit, but really, no. Don't email us if you want to talk about Brexit. But if you want to say something else un-Brexit related, then contact us on setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. You can find us on social media too. That's a thing that people like. But I think email's going to get a revival soon, like the vinyl revival.
The email revival.
Email is coming back. I'm all about the email. And so that's the future as far as I'm concerned. Email us. But that's the end of this week's episode. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Arshan Mohile. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.